Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Faisal Rahman, founder and chief executive of Fair Finance London, explores why there is no such thing as financial exclusion. This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 5th of March 2019.
Cool, thank you. Thank you very much. I've got two mics, so you should really hear me. thank you for inviting me here today. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to come and talk to you about the things that I love to talk about, which is microfinance and maybe why there is no such thing as financial exclusion. As Cam has said, I've been involved... You know what? I'm just going to shift that to here. I've been involved in the world of microfinance for nearly 20 years. And I really have my mother and aunt to thank for it. You see, my parents are from Bangladesh, and as a child of an immigrant family, I have my feet in two different parts of the world, here in the UK, in London, and also in Bangladesh, where they're from. My parents worked hard to remind me of their culture, the culture that they brought with them. And from my perspective, that can often mean something as fantastic as really, really good food that I would always get whenever I went to see my mum. But it could also mean watching really terrible Bollywood movies, which I often had to do, and listen at various times to really, really horrible poetry from my uncle, which is pretty embarrassing when they're all about love and you're in your early teens and you're suddenly understanding what they're talking to each other about. However, when I was quite young, when I was in my late teens, my mum took me to see a Bengali economist who was doing the lecture tour. In universities almost as illustrious as GCU in London, who was talking about how he was lending small amounts of money to women in villages in Bangladesh and how he was empowering them. I found that really fascinating. And as every kind of annoying teenager, you want to ask difficult questions to the lecturer, which I'm hoping that you're not going to do later today. But I kind of pointed out to him things that I believed at the time, that, you know, this shouldn't work, you shouldn't be lending money to people who have none. And of course, you know, the capitalist system is inherently exploiting people, so there's no reason why any of this should work. He then very politely invited me to come and see what he was doing in Bangladesh and said, why don't you come out to Bangladesh and see how it works? And so I did. He then won a Nobel Prize, and I spent the next 2 years trying to figure out why he was right and I was wrong. But in those 2 years, so that was obviously Muhammad Yunus running the Grameen Bank. And in those 2 years, I worked in Bangladesh at the Grameen Bank. I worked on products, and I focused my work in communities where people preferred to choose money lenders over microfinance. And I worked at the World Bank, and I learned a lot around what makes microfinance successful and not successful. But the longer I was there, the more I began to see the similarities between the issues that many of the stories I was hearing from these villages were exactly like the stories that my parents had told me when I was growing up. We're also in the communities that I've become accustomed to in London. I mean, my dad didn't have a bank account until the late 70s, early 80s, I think. He still got paid in check until the late 80s, maybe early 90s. My mum uses a pawn shop quite a lot. I'd had stories of doorstep lending as I'd grown up. So I came back to the UK, and as Cam mentioned, I set up what I think was one of the first microfinance programs, at least in London, if not in the United Kingdom. That was 1999-2000. I started with an overdraft facility because everyone thought I was crazy, and I hustled for cash, I begged for favours, I stole some very good ideas off other people, and I generally overstayed my invitation wherever I went. But I did manage to build a service that served around 600 or 700, mainly women in East London, with small amounts of credit to do small businesses, in Tower Hamlets, Hackney and Newham. Some of it was quite random, £150 for a washing for a fax machine so that a woman could run a translation service for a local university. Occasionally weird, £300 for a group of people who were a community of bodyguards for local clubs and community events. They were being paid to get body armour, very weird. And occasionally really inspiring, lending £500 to a woman who was putting a deposit on a driving instructing car. And she was using that to start a small business to teach other women how to drive. That became a cooperative of 35 women teaching other women how to drive, which is one of the reasons why East London has a higher than national average of women drivers, mostly in the Bengali and Somali community. So really, really amazing things. But I suppose the biggest learning I had at the time was that I'd come back and I found myself not really working on an issue, but not even a problem, as I described it, but an industry. And it's an industry that we now know quite well, but it's an industry that other people call, I suppose, the subprime market. It's the market of around 7 or 8 million people who regularly use a range of alternative finance lenders for their primary sources of credit. They use credit cards, expensive credit cards, as well as installment lending and a range of other type of providers charging anything from 70 to 200%. And within that group, there's probably a couple of million who are using still doorstep lenders or payday lenders charging between 500 and 1500%. There's also around 150,000 people in the UK borrowing from someone who really doesn't actually matter what they charge you. If you don't repay, they'll break your legs, and those would be the illegal money lenders. I did this work for about 5 years, lending locally in East London, and realised that there was really an opportunity to do something different in this market. There was really an opportunity to take on this industry. I'd seen that if you design products well, services appropriately, keep your focus on the customer, and think very hard about the impact that you're trying to make, you could get low defaults, positive impacts, and potentially a scalable business. And I think it was that insight that led me to launch Fair Finance in 2005. Today, Fair Finance is not just me. It is very closely associated, and as some people call it, it's not Faisal's Finance, it's Fair Finance. But it's now an organisation that's gone from me in a converted doctor's surgery in Stepney to a company that has 4 branches across London, 43 staff. We serve around 20,000 people a year. We offer personal finance to people who use loan sharking, high cost credit, business finance to entrepreneurs wanting to start and grow small businesses, and money and debt advice. We've lent around £20 million to that community, and in the last 5 years alone, have worked with around 50,000 people directly. We created about 700 jobs, saved maybe 8,000 people from eviction, and put around £12 million back into the local community of East London. I've grown that business to expanding from London to covering the United Kingdom. We have customers here in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, so I guess that makes us almost an international microfinance organisation. And we've been funded in lots of ways, but my desire with the business was always to find a way to make this work commercially. So we've raised investment capital, and we've borrowed money from banks, and we've done it on our own terms with people who want to back our mission and the vision of the organisation. So over the last 14 years now, I've learnt quite a lot about how to make this work, and I suppose I wanted to spend a bit of time sharing some of the insights on who our customers are and the market they operate in, and maybe give you a bit of a context of why I think some of the terms that are used in this sector are not so appropriate anymore. I mean, I generally focus on action and not words, but I really do struggle with this term financial exclusion, and that's probably why I wanted to be a little bit provocative and kind of dive into it a little bit deeper. So who is our customer? Who is our client? And how has that changed over the last 14 years? So when I launched Fair Finance in 2005, I would say our target market or our typical customer was what you might describe as somebody on a very low income. Their primary income was benefits. They lived in social or council housing. They were generally geographically concentrated. They were often women, usually single mothers. They had little in the way of assets. Their income, while low, was stable. It was regular payments through benefits. It's the traditional market for doorstep lending, catalogues, rent to own, as well as Christmas hamper schemes, which were prevalent in that market. There were incumbent businesses in that area that made good and stable returns. I think when I launched Fair Finance in 2005, 4.3 million people were using doorstep lending, so double what it is today. And the market leader at the time was a FTSE-listed firm worth at the time £2.3 billion, employing 55,000 people. It was a real industry. But that business had been around 135 years, so it was a real incumbent. Not only were the businesses incumbent, the clients were also really geographically concentrated and often with limited economic mobility, no real chance to move, no real chance to go anywhere. Often there were well-established immigrant communities that were served in the same way. And if I'm quite honest, when I started this work, it was actually quite easy to outreach to this community. It was very easy to find the community organisations, the infrastructure that was backed by the state or by charities or the voluntary sector, to define how to reach to the Somali, the Bengali, the Vietnamese, or even the Afro-Caribbean communities in London, because often they were well established and networked within there. Our typical loans in this group were for school uniforms, Christmas presents, the occasional holiday, funerals, emergency costs, the one-off bills, but quite a lot of loans that we made were for people moving into unfurnished council flats, so washing machines, cookers, sofas. People almost had no digital footprint. They liked meeting face to face, and it was exactly how they wanted all of their services offered to them. I mean, I remember my first loan, probably one of my first four loans actually, was to a woman called Irene. She'd borrowed £250 to put a headstone on her husband's grave from a local moneylender in Walthamstow. I met her 4 years after she'd borrowed that £250, and she'd paid over £2,500 and still owed him £250. We refinanced the loan and she was debt-free in 4 months. But these were not unusual stories at the time. I wrote a lot about the issues that not many people were talking about, but these were just so common, it felt ubiquitous. Between 2009 and 2013, our client base started to change again, quite quickly actually. We started seeing people who'd previously had access to mainstream finance and now didn't. A very different group of people. They'd suffered in the recession. They'd lost their jobs. They'd had reduced working hours. They'd less pay. They were moving to contracts. They were part-time, self-employed, 0 hours, multiple jobs. It was the direct opposite of the people we'd been engaging with. Not very stable incomes, not very stable lives. They'd also suffered due to the rapidly changing credit policies in the banking sector. They were going through their own financial meltdown in 2009 and 2011. Missed payments and defaults were starting to increase as people adjusted to new economic realities. The cost of bounced charges was phenomenal and often extortionate, both in terms of cost and to your credit file. I think for the first time people began to realise how important your credit history was. It was your passport to cheap utility bills. It was your passport to rental payments that were quite cheap, as well as mobile bills and internet access. All of these were credit checked because you were post-paying rather than pre-paying for things. So into this market grew a whole new range of lenders taking advantage of high-waged workers struggling to balance increasingly complex and stretched finances. They were digitally comfortable, they had less time to shop around, but were happy engaging remotely for everything they needed, desperately trying to rebuild their credit profile, trying to repair their credit history that they've latterly realised is now damaged for a number of years. If you have a missed payment on your credit file, it's going to be there for 6 years. That's quite a long time to try and clear it. That's quite a long time. And when banks are changing credit policies where one missed payment is enough to reject you, you're going to wait a long, long time to rebuild your credit history. People had something and they'd lost it. These were the boom years for high-cost credit. Payday had been around for a long time, but this is really when people started to hear about Wonga. It was advertising everywhere, and I think one of the reasons why we heard a lot about it was we probably knew someone who was taking it, right? We probably knew someone who was accessing these services. We probably knew someone who'd lost their job, actually. This was a recession that hit all of us. This was a financial crisis that affected everyone. Wonga was the most ubiquitous, but there were others, like guarantor loans. If any of you have I don't know what the word is, but I think if any of you are sitting around in the afternoon listening to the radio, you probably can't help hear the adverts for Amigo loans, which are unbelievably annoying, but apparently are about how banking used to be, but they are expensive. Installment lending, auto finance, all of these companies started to benefit. A secondary market of subprime really grew. These people, like clearly for some people who'd lost their job, they needed debt advice to manage the new issues that they had to address, but most people were surviving somehow, and they didn't need advice. A bit of guidance would be helpful. What they really had was a bad set of options in front of them, and actually thinking about access was probably more important. I remember making a loan to somebody here who was earning £50,000, which was quite strange for us. He was a shift worker on the London Underground. He'd often had periods when he didn't work, but he knew in every year he would be working for 9 months of the year, so he would sometimes have some savings and sometimes borrow some money. No matter how much savings you have, it doesn't take much to get rid of them. And so he wasn't earning for a period because not only did he not have a period of work, he was also ill. He was always comfortable that he could go to his bank and get his overdraft approved or his credit card used, but he suddenly found that in 2010 that his overdraft was converted into a loan and his credit cards had their balance reduced. So he went to a subprime lender, Amigo Loans actually, just to top up and to manage the loss of income that he was managing. He missed a payment, rescheduled a loan, now found that his credit file has been damaged for the 6 years. It meant that any access to any additional credit had to be a high-cost provider. Any variance was now a payday lender. When we met him, he'd racked up quite a few. He'd probably been living like this for about a year and a half. But just to give you an idea, he probably had about eight payday loans that we saw at the time. And this is somebody earning £50,000 a year. He's still working now. He was still working at the time. So he was earning maybe £5,000 a month. And he was paying £2,000 a month in interest charges and £2,000 a month still owed every month to the payday lenders. Every month he was probably just able to cover £2,000 worth of fees rolling over his £2,000 debt every single month. I remember him because not only was he the first time we'd had to deal with a top rate taxpayer, which I used to tell people that if we saw top rate taxpayers in Fair Finance, the world really had collapsed. But I really remember seeing a top-rate taxpayer in the company and thinking, that's odd. But also realising for the first time, somebody turned up at Fair Finance with a spreadsheet of how their finances were structured and how a £2,000 loan would save them close to £50,000 over the course of a couple of years. I mean, that was really different. That was really different to our customer group. It was a no-brainer to make a loan to him, but there weren't really very many brains in the financial system at the time. Working with this group moved our services online a lot more, made us think about quicker decision-making, faster engagement, thinking about what these customers were bringing to us, what they were communicating to us, how they wanted to engage with us, what environment they were coming from, what their expectations were. It also revealed to me the limitations of face-to-face lending, which are fantastic for building information and data for people who have very little, but terrible for assessing people who have lots, and these people had a lot. We might be able to figure out whether we could trust this person. They might be able to build a relationship with us if we could ever get them into the branch. But they had so much other access to information that we didn't have, so much other access to debts and consumer credit, that if we weren't digitally engaged and plugged into all of these data streams, our business would have been left behind. Our decision-making would have been poor. From around 2012, 2013, our customers in London, at least anyway, started to change again. And increasingly from 2015 onwards, we started to see a kind of an evolution, a slightly different demographic of customers who started to come through. They're all employed, but their income was diverse and often variable. Some were earning hundreds of pounds a week, some were earning thousands of pounds a week. Some had PhDs, some were highly educated, they were part-time, fixed-term, contract workers, professionals, skilled manual labourers, artisans, specialists. What connected all of them was that they'd been in the UK for only a few years. They derived from an EU country and English was not their first language. What struck me about this community was how many of the stories that they shared with us was about housing, homes. Many arrived living in the UK in a room, literally a room, sharing a room, a room with three other people, their clothes in a bag, a locker rented for personal effects. They struggled with navigating the system, things we take for granted. English, challenge, not for communicating, but resolving problems. I mean, was it last year there was an IT problem with TSB, Lloyd's TSB? One of our customers lost £500 in that. They'd spoken to them on the phone, they'd gone into the branch, they tried to fix this, but they'd not got it back. Now, that's a week's wage for her. That week, and then the next week of trying to resolve it, and the next week after that, put her into a life of high-cost credit that she hadn't had, which was amazing to think that she'd been in the UK for that long. And this is what pushed her into that. When we met her in December, she was still owed the money. One of our translators went with her to the TSB branch and literally in 15 minutes had got her money back. Now that story was so common. And it's almost exactly the same kind of stories that our debt advisors deal with for people who are struggling with over-indebtedness. Managing the system is complicated. It doesn't matter whether English is your first language or not. There's something here about power and control that people who don't have much don't get to exercise it, don't get to exercise their rights. In this community, the key payment is remittance. something I hadn't really thought about, actually. Something I hadn't realized how important it was either, and how importantly it had to be consistent. They've often left family behind, young children, older family members who are relying on them. These are the breadwinners in the households. Every month they need to send a fixed, regular payment. And often that's what drives borrowing sometimes, because that payment has to be the same every single month. And it isn't discretionary. It isn't discretionary because it's probably paying your kids' food. It isn't discretionary because it's paying the rent that's housing your children and your partner. It's not discretionary because it's paying for the care of your grandparents or your parents. It's key. Every single person here is probably financing four or five people back in the country that they've come from, whether it's Poland, Lithuania, or Romania. They're aspirational. They're economically mobile people looking for opportunities. They've come to a new country with nothing but their skills and by definition are risk takers. And they are hardworking. And I have to say, it's the similarities between that work and that community with the immigrant communities arrived in the 50s and 60s and 70s, my own family and parents, including the exploitation that they've had to deal with due to their lack of knowledge and access and differences, is really telling. It's exactly the same. It's just another repetition of the same issues that people have had to deal with. Probably one of the differences, this group is digitally savvy. My mum still can't use the computer. I still get telephone calls. I mean, she's got a DVD player. Like, who has a DVD player? I still get calls to fix her DVD. But this group is digitally savvy. They're actively using social media, both to communicate with each other and to their family back at home. The information and support networks within the community are often self-funded. They're off the radar. They're not funded by the state. The state is rarely plugged into the networks supporting these communities. You know, outreach is almost impossible without thinking about them commercially. It is really hard to find out how you get into the Romanian community. There isn't. There are Romanian associations in the UK, but they aren't the ones serving the people who are using high-cost credit providers. They're the ones serving the people who aren't employed, who do need help, and are trying to navigate the system. Not the larger group of people who are being financially exploited. Online Facebook groups, LondonEC, which is a really classic system for recently arrived Poles and Lithuanians. It's a trust-based community where people listen to each other for the best advice and often entrench some really bad practice, which takes time to unpick. They've got a real lack of credit history when they arrive. They've got no assets when they arrive. And that's what drives them into the subprime sector. They've got difficulty building a credit file, a credit history. I mean, for example, they might not even be able to get onto the credit register because of the subprime users that they use. And the high cost of the service keeps them financially vulnerable. So when I look back on the groups of people that we've worked with, we've got kind of our traditional group of low-income groups, we've got people with bad credit history, and then we've got communities with no credit history or thin credit files. They're kind of different groups with, I think you can see, totally different needs, totally different social and economic realities, totally different ways of engaging with the state and with the economy. I mean, in truth, we probably worked with all of these groups since the launch of Fair Finance. But the principles of how we established our service and the things that I learned about how you build successful products allowed us to adapt and change to serve the different needs of all those groups. But I think it's probably true to say that we're pretty late to the party. You know, I often say that Fair Finance is 20 or 30 years too late. The subprime high-cost credit lending market, we describe them as exploitative and expensive, but they've done a great job in finding out what this community needs and how they need it. They've adapted to how this community has changed and how that product has to evolve around their needs, around what's required for them. I mean, in my view, it isn't really all about marketing. It's not really all about where you sell yourself and put yourself out. And that is important, you've got to get that right. But it is about the product. It is about that, how you deliver that product, how it's designed. That's the key. If you get that right, almost everything else will kind of take care of itself. So let's look at the product. What do I mean when I say that? What do I mean? And I'll talk about the principles that sit around it, which might sound really obvious, but I'll try and give some examples about what I mean. I suppose the first thing, the most obvious thing to say is that all of these lenders that are in this market, they're really accessible. Now that might sound really, really obvious. Of course they're accessible, everybody's accessible. But I mean, it's not that they just open a branch and wait for people to come to them. They know that people won't choose them. They know that they have to go to them. They know that you have to be in your community. They know that they have to take the forward step out of the branch. They can't wait for you. You'll see them on the street. You'll see them in your community. You'll see them flowering. They'll go to the places where you are, not expect you to come to the places where they are. For them, marketing isn't about a brand, it's about outreach. It really is about community outreach, especially when you're thinking about some of these very, very hard to reach ethnic communities. They are really running some of the best community outreach services I have ever seen. Community managers is like a classic job title that you'll find in a subprime lender. And they do it really well, actually. They do it really, really well. They find them, they build a market, and they scale really fast. You know, we know about doorstep lenders not coming, you know, they come to your home. I'm not sure how many people want a banker coming to their house, but I mean, it's an accessible service and online services that are focused on where you are. What connects all of these customers, though, is the significant variation and flexibility needs in their incomes. The standard lending product in that market just doesn't really work. A monthly lending product that pays out on the 28th or 26th or whatever date that you want to choose probably doesn't really work for a person who has a very variable income and non-standard life and a job. It's kind of pointless if you're paid weekly. It's pointless if you're paid bi-weekly or every Tuesday or if you're paid every 3 months on a cyclical basis because you're actually a contract worker. Probably has a minimum payment if you go to Barclays for a loan. People often forget that it was companies like Wonga that brought to the market those sliders that are now just used everywhere. Like they're all over the place, but that was the place that it was built. I mean, it was the first time people could really match what they wanted to borrow with how long they want. They gave them control, and people miss that. People forget that, and that's why it's been copied. The products were usually really, really simple. Sounds obvious again, but the loans aren't 1,500 or 700%. They're £30 a hundred every month for a payday loan. They're £20 a week for 50 weeks for a doorstep loan. There's no penalty payments. There's no hidden fees. It's really simple. It's really certain. You can budget, you can plan on it. That's much, much better than a random bounce direct debit charge of 30, 40, 50, 60 pounds. The most important commodity that people on stretched budgets have and limited incomes have is not money, but time. We talk about paycheck to paycheck living, but really it's about expenditure to expenditure. It's bill to bill. That's how people live. And those bills can't wait 2 days. That meal can't wait till tomorrow to get an approval. They can't wait 2 days for a decision, a check to clear. They need to know immediately. Speed is what you need. Speed is what you pay for. Speed is a really valuable commodity. But it's only really valuable if it's reliable. If you walk into a branch of a big lender in London, which actually has offices in the Midlands as well, called Oakham, the people in there look like you, actually. If you need their services, they probably do look like you. They're probably from the same community as you. They probably have been in your position. They probably borrowed from Oakham previously and now work for Oakham. They know what it's like to make difficult financial choices. They know what it's like to decide who to pay. They know what it's like when you've got to choose between feeding your kids and paying a bill. They understand when that problem comes up and how to deal with it. That's quite powerful if somebody understands that on the other side. It's something around not judging you for the decisions that you'll make. They'll probably know you by name as well. They'll speak your language. They can probably solve your problem in the office. They don't have to call head office and put you on hold to fix something. They can do it immediately. You can build a relationship with them, right? You can trust them. You know who they are. And that trust gives you reliability. They stick to the rules. They're fair and transparent. And that might sound weird to talk about high-cost lenders, but they kind of stick to what they say they're going to do. They know that they've got to be reliable. Because anyone who's been involved in credit knows that if somebody wanted to not pay you, it's really easy. What are you going to do? Make their credit history any worse? It's not going to make a single bit of difference. They know that what they need to do is give you something that's useful. And in a way, people consider them authentic. I mean, these are all kind of crazy words to think about this market, but these are the words that come out: trust, honesty, relationships, authenticity. They're not in the marketing department. It's not about the product. It sits in the branch. It comes out of the mouth of the people who deliver the service. I mean, you take a step back when you hear all of that and you think about what you've got here. You've got an accessible product. It's flexible. It's highly bespoke. It's relationship-based. And in the best ones, it's authentic. It does what it says. It's basically the holy grail of financial services offering. It is the kind of service that another group in society gets, the very rich. It is exactly the same as what they get. And so when you think about it like that, you realise firstly that the poor now have something in common with the very rich. But you also realise maybe they are making quite a sensible choice. Maybe they've thought about why they're borrowing and why they've chosen this lender over that lender. They're making informed decisions of their own. One of our clients, George, or Horg, he's got a bank account at Barclays. Every week he gets paid, and every week he transfers it to his mobile wallet, which is a card he has called Pocket, which is a prepaid MasterCard that he does all of his banking from. Even though he's got a Barclays account, even though Barclays account is free, he uses Pocket. It helps him avoid overdraft charges because he can't go into an overdraft. That's really important to him. It's got a really, really simple interface. He can access it on his mobile, really simply, straightforward. It helps him budget. It's got some useful tips and things that are in there. Really simple pricing system, 99 pence for anything. There's nothing confusing about it. He borrows from Oakham regularly. Oakham has a really interesting product that he likes. So he uses it for big bills and managing income flows. But they have this one quite interesting product that they realize that people are willing to pay a premium for, which is every 3 or 4 months, if you haven't missed a payment, they'll give you some money back in cash. As long as you've met your payments, they'll give you some cash back. If you know that, that's quite handy, actually, because all you do is you borrow the money for what you need, and then you know you probably pay a little bit, but you're going to get some of it back. I mean, the loan is 900%, right? That isn't what you feature in there. What you're featuring in there is the certainty of some future income based on your ability to manage the loan repayment. It helps him manage his irregular flows. He also sends money back to his family. He uses a mobile app called Azimo. Have you come across it? It's a mobile app that allows you to transfer money really cheaply. And what's really cool about that app is not only is it really simple and straightforward and you can use it, but actually delivers remittance to a remittance shop in the village near where his family is. It isn't to a bank account at a bank where they struggle to get to from the village that they're based in. He'll occasionally use a pawn shop. And if he has a big bill, he'll use it for like a one-off item, a classic. It might be like a water bill or something. He does put money in a local credit union, but they take so long to respond to his application that generally when he gets the money, he's already been somewhere else and he finds that he becomes over-indebted, which is just a strange thing for him to have had to go through a couple of times, more money than he's expected. I mean, George is not rich by any means. I mean, he's using all of these systems. He's not rich at all. He works three jobs. He walks from Brixton to the city in London where his works are. He walks even in the rain, right? He walks every time. It's £1.50 to take a bus. He has to take two buses, so he can't do that. £6 a day, he doesn't do it. His discretionary spend is food. 2-for-1 deals at McDonald's, that's his holy grail. It's his godsend. He lives in a shared house now. He has his own room, which is good, but he has short-term lets because frankly, he's not British. And he struggles to get anything longer than 6 months. That's quite unstable for some people. His bills are paid by his landlord, so he can't actually build his own credit history. He gives him a lump of money. He's not able to build. Nothing's in his name. It's all in his landlord's. That's the only way the landlord will trust the tenants who are in there. He doesn't know if he can stay after Brexit. He can't get the right advice. He doesn't know whether he should pay for a lawyer. He doesn't know all these questions. He's struggling. He's still fighting with one of his employers for his last paycheck. Life's not great, actually, for George, but if you ask him, he's okay, actually. He's getting by. He's getting by because one of the questions that we often ask about well-being or finance or financial health is you often judge yourself by your peers. And for him, compared to a lot of other people that he lives with, he's doing all right. I would struggle, honestly. I'm sure any of us would struggle. But for him, it's okay. But if you're serious about helping George, a small loan is not going to fix all of those other things I've just described that are problems in his life. All of those things that are making him financially vulnerable. He's going to miss a payment with Fair Finance not because he wants to. I think he's going to miss a payment with Fair Finance because something's going to happen with one of those jobs. One of them's going to hold a payment against him. His landlord's going to give him a week's notice. Something that I don't have any visibility or control over is going to make that person financially vulnerable, not advancing him a loan. A loan might help, doing it badly might make it worse, but it's not going to fix it, actually. And if I think about how I want, or how I should, or how finance should help somebody, we need to think about these kind of solutions in our organisations and in our interventions. Our job isn't really about lending money and offering cheap credit. It's about giving people agency and freedom to make their own choices, the advocacy and the rights to empower themselves to fix these problems, because they know what they need fixed. They just need some help finding the right support to do it. I think if you just think about that description of George that I just gave, you've actually got quite a savvy operator, right? He's using five different financial service providers, whether they're online and mobile, whether they're the bank, non-mainstream. He's quite a sophisticated user of finance, actually. And I think if we miss, I think we miss that when we use words like financial inclusion, because financial inclusion focuses on including people into the system. It's generally been about bringing people into banks and credit unions as the good, because that's what financial inclusion means, and everything else is the bad. But that's not the reality, actually. That isn't even the truth for many of these people. They use these services all the time in the way that works for them. They're interlinked, they're commingled, they overlap, and they are massively fluid. They're also intrinsically connected to other things that aren't finance related. Welfare rights, advocacy, legal support, employment assistance, access to health, all of these are part of how we think about fixing the problem. Limiting ourselves to thinking just about financial inclusion focuses on banking or cheap credit, not the problem. The problem is the vulnerabilities that these people are living on. And if we miss that, we miss the real need that we're trying to focus on, and our solutions are short-term, and our impact is probably substandard. If we don't take the time to understand that and really ask ourselves what people are, what the lived experience is for people in this market, we'll keep wondering years from now why policy interventions fail, why people remain poor, why alternatives don't succeed in changing the market. I do believe, though, that if you get it right, you can create things and choices that people choose and make a difference in their lives permanently. Because I think it is possible to make change. It is possible to get it right. Irene, who I mentioned earlier, the woman who we lent, who borrowed £250 for a headstone on her husband's grave, that story in itself is a reason enough to want to do something in this market, in this sector. That story in itself is an inequality and exploitation you'd want to fix. That story in itself should drive us to wanting to create solution. But there's something more about that story that I haven't told you. So that loan was around 10 years ago, 10, 12, no, 13 years ago. The person she borrowed was from a local moneylender, a man known as Loan Man Dave. A couple of years ago, I got a call from Loan Man Dave. He wanted a job. We'd put him out of business. His clients had chosen us en masse and didn't go back to him. We'd made a permanent difference, not just for the individual, not just for Irene, but for all of those people in Walthamstow who were using that service. And I think that's got to be our target. That's got to be our measure of success. We're not here to be transactional. We'll miss the point. We're here to make a permanent change on people. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you would like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.